Welcome. I'm Larry Olson. And what's on your mind? Once set, it delivers your life. To change the outcomes we want, we must change the plays we're running. Join us at Mindset Playbook with real people, real talk, for real insight.
Today's episode is sponsored by Apernio, an achievement acceleration company whose approach to professional development enables clients to gain insights and perspectives to live, work, and engage with more success.
I want to welcome everybody to Mindset Playbook, and thank you so much for investing your time with us. My guest today is Dr. Kathy Abels. She was born and raised in Southern California, where she earned a PhD in clinical psychology and served clients in her private practice for nearly two decades. Pivoting career, she joined her family in 2003 to focus solely on philanthropic efforts, and utilizing her background in psychology, Dr. Abels was instrumental in developing the Simon Scholars Program into what it is today, an intensive college prep support initiative that aims to help disadvantaged high school students overcome adversity and develop into college-educated leaders who are actively engaged in their communities. The Simon Scholars Program currently serves 22 high schools in Southern California, in Orange and San Diego counties, and awards almost 200 scholarships annually. Since its inception, it has been honored by the NAACP for its contributions to the Atlanta, Georgia community, and recognized by the National Scholarship Providers Association as the Independent Scholarship Provider of the Year, which is just amazingly distinguished an award. Dr. Abels, with your background in clinical psychology, what was it about the Simon Scholars Program that caused you to leave a very successful practice and join your family to work with disadvantaged high school students?
First of all, thank you for having me. I'm very honored to be here today.
You're welcome.
Well, it was a gradual transition. As much as I loved being in private practice, the truth of the matter is this working with these students became a passion that I cannot describe. It was very interesting. Seeing patients, I got to see gradual change in my clients. It was a slow process. Being a psychotherapist. With these students, I would bring them into the program and I would see almost instantaneous change. And just, it was, and I got to relate to them at a whole different level. And the program just evolved really quickly. We were adding more programs, we were adding more students. And the reward that I got back from the giving that we were able to do was, it was contagious, it was addicting, it was just wonderful. And it started to take so much of my time. It was so creative. It was so engaging and rewarding that I really couldn't split myself into enough people to do the work that needed to be done. And at some point, I just had to make a decision as to where I was going to be.
So what is this program all about anyway? I mean, you're taking disadvantaged high school students. What exactly does that mean?
Well, what it is, what makes us, I think, special and different is that we do early intervention. A lot of scholarship programs select students kind of at the end of their senior year. Okay, they find a student that's been very successful, they have good grades, they have good scores, you know, they're a proven entity, and they give them a college scholarship. What we do is we select the students at the end of their 10th grade year. And we look for a certain kind of student. We are looking for kids who are intelligent, who show drive and motivation, good grades. We want to have aptitude, but they come from difficult backgrounds, whether it's economically, personally, you know, just different obstacles that they've had to overcome in their lives. And they may not be a shoe into college, or they may not have that that narrative that I am going to college. It may be kind of a blip on their screen in their brain, but it's there somewhere, or somebody, you know, on their campus may think they're a candidate, but they may not believe that yet.
Are they typically a young person that grows up in a family that the parents or those around them have not gone to college themselves?
Yes, exactly. I'd say probably 95% of our students are what we would call first-generation college students. Okay. So they are navigating this road for the first time. A lot of them are actually the oldest in their family. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, and so they're going, it's life-changing not only for our students, but for their entire family. It can affect younger siblings, cousins, and just the whole mindset, the mindset playbook here, the whole mindset of the whole family about who we are. Many of them are immigrants. The parents often don't speak the language and don't have the resources.
What do you think some of the beliefs are about college? I mean, does it even come up or?
Well, it depends somewhat on the families. Okay. I think for some, it's an idea that's unattainable. Mm. We're poor. Nobody's done it. We can't do it. We don't have the money. If you're lucky, you'll go to a community college down the street. You will stay home, and that will be the end of it. For others, it's impossible. Mm. It's just a pipe dream. Mm. And for some, we've come here. We've come here from a foreign country, and you will go, and no matter what, we don't know how we're going to make that happen. We don't know how to navigate this system, but we'll figure out a way. We hope it can happen. Work really hard, and maybe it will happen. Mm-hmm. But we really don't know how to do this, but we'll try.
Yeah.
So there's, it depends on, there's a lot of cultural differences, depending on ethnic backgrounds, depending on, so many things. And then we also have kids who come from a lot of dysfunction. I mean, we have all kinds. We have kids who come from extremely close families that are just from poverty, don't know how to deal with this kind of thing. And then we have kids from major dysfunction, major trauma, where there's just no support. I have kids who are homeless, literally. So
I was a first generation that went to college. Mm-hmm. And yip, yip, yo, so what, who cares? What difference does it make? Until I had children, and we were in an environment where if you didn't find a outfit to be able to help your child write the letters that were necessary to pick the colleges to find out, what they were best suited for, none of which ever came up in our family. We never had those kind of conversations, and I think I was fortunate that it wasn't as challenging as it is today. Mm-hmm. But not having all of those disadvantages, it was difficult at best then.
Yes.
I can imagine. What do you see as some of the greatest obstacles that you have to help them overcome to even make this successful?
Well, I think first of all, it's changing the mindset, appropriately given this podcast. I think the first step is just a self-belief. Our kids come into the program with the idea that I don't know if this can happen. Some of them weren't going to even apply to be in our program. It's a pretty difficult application process. There's an interview and an essay and recommendations. So some of them have to have the fortitude just to get through that. And this is a 15, 16-year-old kid, so can imagine just going through that process.
Sure.
So that's the first thing, is believing in yourself. And so we kind of have to build them up, that you have this, you can do this. It's a scary place to think of a university and leaving home and just going through that. That's the first thing. But I think also it's the obstacle of leaving the family. Some of our students come from very tight-knit families where they have responsibilities that are huge, taking care of younger siblings, translating for parents. The idea of leaving home and leaving the responsibilities is huge, and the families getting on board with that and supporting that this could be life-changing for everybody.
Boy, there's got to be some guilt issues that some of these young children have.
Oh, we've had to have some conversations with parents. Your child just got into Stanford. We got to talk, and they're not letting them go, and we've had these conversations. And then it's just the process of building them up so that they can navigate the college environment when they get there, because the statistics are not good for this population. They can have a 4.5 GPA, pass every AP exam on the planet, get to a university environment and drop out because
of culture.
Culturally, they feel like fish out of water. Mm. They don't have the support. They may not have the study skills. They may not feel like they can relate to the other students.
Nor do the students that are in the college are able to have the skills necessary to be able to embrace these individuals with these challenges. Sometimes they can be ostracized, made fun of, and unfortunately.
What fantastic insights we are getting into in this episode. If this resonates with you and is provoking and of value, please consider the best-selling book of Get a Vision and Live It by your host, Larry Olson, at apernio.com. His book has been an inspiration to many of Mindset Playbook's guests, and you'll find everything you need to live the best version of your life now. The results you'll get will absolutely amaze you. Find the book at apernio.com in the shop. And now, let's get back. You won't want to miss what's to come in this episode of Mindset Playbook.
And you even know kids from privilege who go away to college have adjustment issues.
Absolutely.
You know, the freshman, depression and homesickness. So multiply that by 1,000, you know. So we really work on those things, and we work on the process of helping them write their essays, helping them find the correct school, the best match for their personality, for their major, for their talent, for their passion. Mm. All those things are really important. We actually take our kids on college tours, and we go. It started out, everything just keeps evolving with this program. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And we started out with bus tours around local. Then it became, because now I'm out in California. At one point I lived in Atlanta, which is where you heard that award. But now I'm out in California full time. And then we started taking them on an airplane from Southern California to San Francisco and doing all those very cool colleges up there, like Stanford and Berkeley and, you know,
probably
San Francisco.
First plane too.
Yeah. So a lot of them, I mean, just getting, you know, on the plane and dealing with the anxiety without Xanax, you know, on the plane for these kids. And just the whole idea of some of the families letting their daughters go on a trip with boys and staying in a hotel. And I mean, there were just a lot of,
this was real.
Yeah, so and going
this
on a trip.
This is my little baby you're taking away from me.
Yes, we had a number of conversations with parents on, please, we're going to take care of your child. And, you know, thinking about my liability insurance at this point. But just the world opening up. Some of these students had not left their barrios in Santa Ana, where we have a lot of schools. And this was a huge, huge thing. But opening up your mind to possibilities and what that does. And then just the process of growing as a person so that you can, go to school and see yourself as something beyond where you came. Mm-hmm. And so we do retreats and that are powerful and emotional, and that's where my psychology would come in, and you know, tears and joy and hugs and just you know, powerful experiences for all of us. I'm saying as an adult, you know, watching this and watching them grow in a weekend to see, you know, it was just you know, we would do a couple retreats a year, so I'd have each student would probably have four experiences like that plus other retreats we would do in ropes courses.
How long would these retreats be?
Usually like a 3-day weekend, 2 to 3 days, depending. And to see them blossom, you know, a shy kid in the corner to a leader in a matter of hours, you know, with the support of the other students. Because we really, what our intention was creating, we had cohorts at each high school. So my setup was to a minimum of 8 to 10 students in each high school, so that they had an extended support group.
Okay. You know, that makes a lot of sense.
Especially when you look at peer pressure in high school, and being a student and being a good student is not a cool factor when you're 16.
No, it's not.
You know,
you're in the nerd, what they used to call the nerd classification.
Exactly.
Yeah, which was not the group you wanted to be in, because everybody else was being social and whatnot. And in hindsight, you know, the nerds are the ones that ended up everybody working for.
That's right. That's what I would tell them. You guys, don't worry about it now. They'll be coming to you for a job, you know, and looking up to you. And, as you know, we have kids from, you know, highly infiltrated gang areas where they'd had to, you know, avoid being in a gang, and were getting pressured, and, you know, and they would have this group.
Who do you think you are going off to college?
Yeah.
And how powerful is peer pressure?
Oh, very, yes. So for them to have this extra support of their cohort at school, and then this larger one of all of the Simon Scholars became their second family, and really helped them, you know, kind of keep on the path. And we had, I'd say rules and expectations for them. I mean, we have what we call Simon Scholar swag. And they have T-shirts and bags, and they carry them. And, you know, my maiden name is Simon. That's our family name. And I would tell the kids, beginning of every retreat, you guys have my name on a shirt, so make me proud, you know. And they wore it proudly, and, you know. And so it became an identity. It was creating that Simon Scholar identity. And this is who I am. I'm a Simon Scholar, and this is what is expected of you. And so when they would go to a party, and, you know, the kids would tell me, I was getting pressure to use drugs or drink, and I would say, no, I can't because of my scholarship. They would use that as their excuse to stay, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, so it gave them a little bit of leverage there, yeah. So, you know, just kind of beefing them up, you know, for a couple of years to get ready for that transition.
Mm-hmm. That's why you started in the 10th grade. So you've got this. So we've got a lot of parents or listeners and have children that are going to go off to college or already in college. You've learned a lot about the role the parent plays in this transition. Mm-hmm. And you're coming from the disadvantage, but I would imagine the advice is sound with a child coming from a dynamically functional family relative. Like, what was it, Brad Shaw's that said 95% of families are happily dysfunctional?
Definitely.
So we don't know when we're growing up until these changes occur. We leave home, or then we start getting feedback from our peers as, oh, you're going to college? Aren't you somebody? Mm-hmm. Right? And so you have to, it seems like, build these almost to overcome, how do I overcome these objections?
Yes.
You know, one of the things that you gave them for the drug deal is, no, I'll lose my scholarship. I mean, that's beautiful. But what advice would you give to how parents can be, you know, the best part of the culture as well when they've got a young child going out into the world, and you know, you don't want to be the helicopter parent too much too. But what have you seen that's been the best advice that you've been able to offer?
Oh, there's so many. I think it's really helping, and this goes for all levels of privilege to poverty to everything. I think, you know, kids of privilege have issues too. You know, I think some of them have had it almost too easy, and I think then when they get out into the world, they don't know how to deal with problems, or people don't believe they've earned it on their own. And so they get the other side of that. There's that fraud piece. You know, well, if I didn't have all this help, maybe I wouldn't be so successful. And they have a whole other set of psychological, you know, kind of demons to deal with on that level. But I think also, I think this starts really young, is helping kids really see who they are. And seeing what they're good at and what they're passionate about and how they play. Mm. You know, you can see that at 3, 4, or 5 years old. How does my child play? What are they drawn to? And really embracing that and celebrating that. Because I think so many parents are fighting, my kid's an artist, my kid's a you know, whatever it might be, but helping them find a channel for that.
Sure.
And being true to thyself. It's always that thing, you know, it's standing up for what they believe in, and being able to voice that. I think the voice is very important.
What happens when they stand up for what they believe in and it's in opposition to the family unit or to the culture in that, you know, the barrio or whatever the scenario may be? We all have grown up in a culture. of either having siblings or not, or parents or not, or whatever. And that kind of is how we learn how to operate. Now, when we have the opportunity to get this scholarship, or to our parents decide they want us to go to college, where are the I really am fascinated by, because I think even if we're out of college, we still have these issues of how do I fit in.
Yes.
Where you said something about you can notice these things and how your children play at 3 and 4. What are some of the classics in behavior that we can develop strategies to best be of service to these transitions that our kids are going through?
I think it's a matter of having conversations, and being supportive of their ideas. So I don't think it has to be like a fight or a struggle. It's a sharing of ideas, really. I think so many times people see it as my child's rebelling if they're going against something I believe in. I mean, you get that into politics. And I think being open-minded as parents. I mean, it's one thing if my kids being violent, and those are not,
That's not okay.
That's not okay. I mean, I think there are certain things that are just not acceptable, and I get that. But I think ideas, and I'm thinking of a scholar, you brought to mind one of my scholars, I'll say her name, Ruby. She's amazing. But she grew up in a Hispanic family. She's extremely quiet. And she was one of 7 kids. She was the youngest, all boys. She was the youngest, and she was a girl. Wow. And when she was about 4 years old, her mother had a traumatic brain injury. I think she had a tumor and was operated on, and it did not go well. And so she was basically not functioning. And so mom was put in a kind of, a brain trauma kind of home. And so she had no mom for all intents and purposes from that point on. And dad was from a traditional Mexican family who basically had an elementary school education, is raising these 7 kids on his own. And she basically had 8 dads, or 7 dads with older brothers and her. Uh-huh. And, the mindset was girls are to be, traditionally not go to college or to get married when they're out of high school and have babies. That's basically what her role was assigned. But Ruby is a very bright young lady, beautiful inside and out, and I think on some level knew that she was destined to do more. But very understated and never talked back. But somebody took notice to her in high school. She was her track coach, and said, "You need to apply for this program." She didn't have the confidence to do it, and somebody forced her. Like the day before, she tells me the story, I finally turned it in. She came into our program, didn't say a word. I did her interview, and there's something about her just captivated me. I took her. I said, "Okay, we're taking this kid." I mean, I don't know, something just grabbed me as I got it. There's something in there, there's a spark.
Yeah.
And this girl blew me away. The first retreat, she set the standard on courage. I've never seen.
No kidding.
We were doing some exercise where involved a lot of honesty and courage about telling the truth. It was a role play thing, and she got up there and just blew me away. Blew the whole everybody and got us all in tears and created an honest kind of environment for the rest of the weekend. And used her
kind
voice.
Set the stage,
yeah. Used her voice like I've never seen, and changed her and changed us and just, and I just, wow.
that is such a powerful thing that you're doing, because you're actually giving someone who's been so inundated by their culture a voice.
Yeah. And that's what she said.
That doesn't have to necessarily support the mandates and the belief systems and the, living in Houston, we went and had dinner with an anesthesiologist. They were next door neighbors. And he said he hated his job. After I said, "What a cool job to have." And he said, well, my grandfather was one, and my dad was one. And so it was not his choice. And here is a privileged person
that
didn't get to use his own voice. So the parallels are
amazing. And it doesn't matter what walk of life. It's just, but she ended up using this voice the rest of the time in her program and into life now. She's now 27. She's a teacher. But this went throughout the program from, I am going to college. Her father wasn't going to let her go on the college tour. She brought him in and had our staff talk to him. He wasn't going to let her go to college. And now, I mean, he has apologized to her. I'm so sorry. I doubted you. I was just doing my best. This is what I learned, you know?
Yes.
And it's amazing. She's teaching high school Spanish and teaching other girls, you know, in somewhat of an impoverished environment to use their voices. And she does it in such a gracious way. Like, if you saw this girl, she's so sweet, but so powerful. Yeah. And so you talk about it doesn't have to be done in a rebellious, you know, way. It's just, I mean, she's an example of somebody with such poise, you know. And so, in terms of that, it's just, I think it's having that conversation and really asking your kids what they're about and what they want to do. And I think we're so prone to just assuming what our kids are going to be and what they should be.
And what we'd like them to be.
What we'd like them to be. You know, you should be a doctor, you should be a lawyer. Those are, you know, three things you can be: a doctor, lawyer, and accountant. Those are like three jobs you're allowed to be in my culture. You know, you know, I think there's a lot more there.
Yeah. And I have found in the works that I do that finding your voice is sometimes the most difficult thing to do because there's a people-pleasing side that we've been brought up with. Mm-hmm. I might offend somebody if I tell them how I really think. So some people go through their whole life biting their tongue.
Exactly right.
And they're like, they're the walking dead. You know, they're not even alive because they know that if they use their voice, they would be ostracized. Their parents wouldn't like them anymore. Their friends wouldn't. You know? And it's so the opposite.
Exactly.
Because,
and that's what leadership is about, right? And that's what we really work on with our scholars is you know, taking that risk, you know, in a good
way. And how do you make that risk comfortable? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know it's going to be uncomfortable, but I guess the word is safe.
And that's, and I think that's what we do between the cohorts, between the trust in our group, which we somehow, well, I think the first thing I do, and this is intentional, is how we select our kids. And being a psychologist, and I can't do this anymore because the program's too big, but I used to be at every interview. Mm. And I mean, it would take months. I mean, I finally got, my son is now doing the operations of the program. He's like, Mom, we can't do this. We can't continue this. But I would be at every interview of every scholar.
Wow.
And it would take weeks because I'd have to go to this school and that school. And I would, you know, with my psychology thing, and nobody can do the interviews the way you do because, you know, you've been doing this for 20 years. And I would really, besides getting the story, I was really looking for character. I was looking for how judgmental is this person? How open are they? Are they going to be open to other types of kids from different ethnic backgrounds, from different viewpoints? Because I almost like, I guess it's a little bit of playing God in the group because I would want to bring kids from different walks of life to get together. It's so cool to see the popular cheerleader with the so-called nerd kid eat lunch together, which you couldn't do in real life. Mm-hmm. But we made real life out of that. And these people would become friends. And how talk about a mindset change. A mind shift, would that be for for themselves, you know, to have that happen in organically, right? Because it would not happen on a high school campus.
And you can't tell somebody to do that.
No.
That has to come through
experience. And it would happen in our group because they would start talking in a group and start sharing real experiences about life. And we're all human. Yeah. And unfortunately, we don't get that opportunity a lot of times in life. Because of the situations we're put into.
And if we do speak our mind too much, Sometimes we're in the principal's office, or sometimes
that's
we're incarcerated. Or,
exactly.
You know, I'm not saying you become a criminal when you speak your mind.
But people get mad, and you know,
yeah, but
gosh.
We've got pretty strong beliefs, whether they're political or
especially
religious.
Especially now.
Yeah. And that can be a real decisive element in any relationship. And safety is something that is easier said than done.
Exactly.
Because you have to, like you said, you have to be open to them going in a different way than your way.
That's right.
And we're not wired that way. We're wired to maintain our sanity. And because I love you, I'm telling you this.
Yeah.
This is in your best interest.
Yeah.
And then you, apparently, one of the reasons you love the interview so much is to look for that element where the voice was there but not heard.
That's exactly right. And you get them one-on-one or in a group with a, you know, and you can pull that out and see what kinds of kids are going to mesh. You know, they can be from all different walks, but when they get together, there's somehow a trust over time would develop. And they would, it's a funny story because we have at least two or three people coming out as gay in our program. We always started to become kind of funny, like, you know, it's, you know,
yeah, this,
they're like, this is the place
is
where
so
you come
safe.
Out.
Yeah.
It's so safe. We're going to come out here, you know, because it was that safe for these people
embraced.
To come out, and they felt safe, and everyone would hug them and we love you. And that was their first safe place. And you're talking about, you know, Hispanic kid from the barrio who's machismo family, that this is, oh my God, my uncle's going to kill me, you know, but I can do it here, you know.
Yeah.
And that's their truth.
That's that trust, too.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's a lot of confidentiality.
Oh, yeah. That's a big thing. We used to say what happens in Simon Scholar's retreat stays in like Vegas, stays
like
here.
Vegas.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure that not everyone was a success.
That's true.
What were some of the ones that kind of hit you in the heart the most that didn't work out?
You know, it's funny when I look at, there's a couple. We had a couple that defrauded, you know, they weren't who they say they were.
Okay.
Yeah, made up a story. Okay. Usually we're pretty good at sifting that out during the assessment process. I'm kind of a detective, and I would find things out.
Okay.
Parents would say who they were, or not making, you know, making money that they weren't making, and things like that. I had one student who was dealing drugs on campus.
That was okay.
Now, you know, you could say that was a success.
That was their
voice. That was success. That was their voice. However, you know, was it a failure? I don't know, because we handled it. And I think it was a life lesson for him and all the rest of the scholars.
Okay.
So, you know, we've had those things. There's choices we've had to make to remove people from the program for poor choices.
Okay.
But again,
was
part
it
of the life,
they
you know,
weren't being in the best interest of not only themselves, but the culture you were trying to create?
There we had rules.
Okay.
We had standards, and they weren't meeting them. Either it could be grades, and we give them a few strikes.
Sure.
They had certain grades they had to meet. We had certain rules that if they were broken, were immediate expulsion from the program.
Gotcha. Yeah.
You know.
But you didn't.
Violations
you
like
You never
that.
Had one where there wasn't a misrepresentation. There was basically a inability to adapt to this new culture.
I'm trying to think about that.
Dropping out of college, or they.
We have had a couple kids who just didn't make it through college, and there were various reasons.
Yeah.
And sometimes we would put them on, you know, either suspension or probation, depending on the situation.
Yeah.
I mean, your parent gets sick and you have to go take care of them. There's different reasons. One thing that we really pushed was communication. Communicate. Let us know what's going on.
Okay.
You don't communicate, we don't know what's going on. And we're trying to reach you 3, 4, 5 times.
Yeah.
There's no excuse for that.
Yeah.
But if you have a reason, it's legitimate, and you get back to us, we'll work with you.
Yeah, sure.
That's life.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We're trying to kind of emulate real life situations so that they, when they get out into the real world, this is what will happen.
Mm-hmm.
When you get a job, when you are in a relationship,
mm-hmm.
these are things, you know, that you have to adhere to in order to be successful
yeah.
with people and in your career.
So one, I believe that our options for change come from our habits, attitudes, beliefs, or expectations, and all of which we're not born with. They're learned behaviors, basically. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking genetics or we're predisposition to, or I have a talent in athletics and I really didn't work at it, or whatever that may be, those gifts. Do any of those habits, attitudes, beliefs, or expectations stand out more as being on your side for people who have succeeded than that those that one isn't as important as?
I'm not sure.
So, of the habits, attitudes, beliefs, and expectations, is it the attitude sometimes that can create success or hold someone back? Is it a belief that they have? Could it be an expectation? Because habits kind of come from whatever that attitude or belief is, right? We develop these habits around it. And you're dealing with all of those.
Yeah, I think when I look at, I'm trying to kind of think about the kids in our program who are the most successful. And they seem to have kind of this innate life force. And I guess that's, maybe that's just an attitude about life.
Okay.
And it's how they... Because I look at them, they come, you know, like you may have a few siblings, and they all come from the same background and the same hardship, same experiences. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And one child in the family will somehow overcome.
Yeah.
This is a study someday I want to do.
Yeah.
Why is this one kid out of this family?
Yeah, and how do you nurture that?
Yes.
Right? Because that can still be stifled.
Definitely. But there's something about an experience they have when they were younger, or their innate personality where the world responded to them in a certain way, something where they have an attitude about life that I can overcome and I will get through.
Okay.
And there's a persistence.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a really good question. I don't have the full answer, and
it's
I would like to have it.
Well, I'll give it to
I'd
you
like the formula.
Sometime when you'd like to know what it is, and our audience as well. I'm teasing, of course. I do have the answer, but I'm not going to share it now.
Well, why not?
So, unfortunately, time has like flown, which it has a tendency to do when something's fascinating and worth listening to. So thank you for what you've shared. It sounds to me, if I was a guessing man, that you've probably had over 90% success with these people over the last, 17, 18 years? You started in 03?
We started in 03. I would say our success is growing because we've done a lot of experimentation with the program and been able to add more and more. It started out actually just as a monetary scholarship, which we realized was not going to work, and that's when we started bringing in all
they
the programs.
Didn't have any support.
Yeah, the support is what's really important.
Gotcha.
Much more than finances. The finances are a nice perk. And I think being selected is a perk for them. Just, hey, they selected me, I must have something, and they start to believe in themselves. But the ongoing support, and our support doesn't end when they graduate high school. It continues into college. And now we have had some alumni programs that kind of got stifled during the pandemic, which we're trying to get off the ground again.
Yeah.
So,
so the people out there that would like to participate in the scholarship for these young individuals, mm-hmm. How do they go about doing that?
Well, right now we partner with schools.
Okay.
So we're in schools right now in San Diego County and in Orange County. Most of our growth is in Orange County.
Okay.
So we have a couple of donors that support the program. We would like to grow.
In the more. So you're not saying no to having more money?
Of course not.
So did they do that? How do they do that?
They would contact our organization, SimonScholars.org.
Okay.
Yeah.
SimonScholars.org.
Yeah, and we don't do a lot
of... We'll have that information for you.
Yeah, we don't... We tend to do large donations where somebody would support a cohort of students over a six-year period.
Oh, okay.
So that's how we work. So they would sponsor a class of scholars and commit to that.
Nice.
Yeah. So, you know, it's we're always looking to grow and add another school, always.
You know what I think would be fun is to, you kind of think a little bit about it and see if there's a graduate or someone in the program that would like to be on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So we could kind of get that perspective.
That would be
too,
great. You know? I could think of a few off the top of my head that would love it. That are articulate and I think have benefited and have their perspective would be great.
Yeah, that would be. I think that would be very interesting for everybody, right? So it's. I think the whole point behind our conversation is how important it is to be in an environment where your voice can be heard.
Mm-hmm.
And let's define voice by that passion and quest inside each one of us that if not nurtured, which your program does, can lie dormant and not be exposed because of fear, because of culture. So many things can keep us from speaking up. And I know it happens with me. You know, I kind of get a sense of what's going on and who am I around and would this be appropriate or not? And that's probably called socialization. But I think that you've offered a voice to these people that would not have been heard otherwise. And kudos. Kudos to you and to your, you know, your family and the idea that these people need to be able to have an opportunity, as we all do.
We all do as humans.
And yes, and thank you for picking psychology to do your studies in so that you could bring that to the party with these young people. Do you have anything you'd like to share to kind of wrap it up with the listeners out there, you know, who are all going through their struggles and their successes, but yet are always inside their head having that conversation going on with them about how they're doing in this thing called life?
No, I just, you know, I think it's just important to, you know, be true to thyself. And, you know, that sounds really kind of cliche, but I think especially now with the, you know, coming out of the isolation of the pandemic, I think everybody's trying to find their equilibrium again. And, you know, and get back out there and figure out who they are in the world again. Yeah. I think it's been kind of a strange time in that regard.
Yeah.
So I think it's, you know, to start connecting with people and just to be honest and open and accepting of other people and, you know, just to work on that connection.
Very nice. Very nice. And having been someone who's rather kept themselves a little bit isolated, mm-hmm. I think you have to start saying yes to things.
Mm-hmm.
When you get invited, say yes. You don't have to say yes to things that are going to be holding you back or and not in the best interest of those around you. But we're taught to say no so often in our lives.
Yeah, out of fear.
Out of fear.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's no way to live a life. So thank those of you who said yes to listening to this podcast. Thank you, Dr. Abels.
Thank you.
Kathy, who her and her husband Eddie have become great pickleball partners with my wife and I. So I'm so grateful that you would do this podcast with us. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you for having me.
You're so welcome. And all the best to all of you. And remember again, wherever you happen to be in your life right now, it's exactly where you need to be. It's just a matter of choice. So you heard a little from Kathy on choose your own voice. And you'll ultimately create a culture around you that'll be supportive. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, we ask that you please subscribe and share with your friends and associates. Join Larry next time for the Great Automotive Experience, where you'll hear the tools, techniques, and strategies that industry insiders have implemented to improve both the associates' and the customer's automotive experience. Larry's guest, Anthony Voltaggio, a former general manager and owner, will share his stories on how he has taken stores to heights they have never dreamed of.